This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Friends, family, fellow athletes, welcome back to the TriDot Podcast. We've got a great show lined up for you today. I've got Andy and Abby joining us. So in total, it's an Andrew, an Andy, and an Abby sitting around talking about real-world race day nutrition case studies. What can we learn from studying the race day caloric intake data of other athletes? Today, we will find out. And podcasting simply doesn't get better than this. Our key guide to the world of fuel and hydration is Andy Blow from Precision Fuel and Hydration. Andy is a sports scientist with a degree in sports and exercise science from the University of Bath, an expert in sweat, dehydration, and cramping. Andy has worked with multiple Formula One racing, NBA, NBL, MLB, and Premier League sports teams, as well as many professional triathletes. An elite-level triathlete in his younger days, Andy has finished in the top 10 of the Ironman events, as well as winning an Xterra World title. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, Andrew. Thanks for the invite.
Also joining us from Precision Fuel and Hydration team is Abby Coleman. Abby is a sports scientist who completed her degree in sports and exercise science at the University of Bath. She previously worked at the Porsche Human Performance Center as an exercise physiologist before joining Precision Fuel and Hydration as their resident sports scientist. Abby, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be a guest, Andrew.
I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set topic, and then wind things down with our cool down. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
We can control a lot of things in endurance sports, but the weather is not one of them. Abby, Andy, for our warm-up question today, from all your time training, racing, and just all around outdoors adventuring, what was the worst weather you have found yourself exposed to? Abby, it's your first time on the show, so we'll lead off with you today. What was it for you?
I suppose mine is somewhat artificial in that we couldn't really call it weather.
Okay.
Environmental conditions would be more accurate, and I'd have to go for when I was working as an exercise physiologist out of the performance center. I jumped in the heat chamber, so this was about 38 degrees Celsius. That's around 100 Fahrenheit.
Thank you for that conversion. I would not have known. So yeah, I needed that.
Very, very hot, very, very humid in this
yeah.
in this chamber. Andy will attest to that. He knows it well
sure.
as well. No fan. It's very, very sweaty, very quickly. Static treadmill and just very rapidly. So within sort of 40 minutes, I was spent. I was completely done. I came out and felt rather ill. Now, when you're in a heat chamber, you measure core body temperature, and that just was spiking close to 40 degrees. So at that point, you really do want to pull a person out. And that was, I've always hated the heat. I'm a redhead.
Yeah.
So I've always struggled in hot weather, but that was by far the worst thing I've ever experienced.
So in that particular occasion, like, well, why were you in the heat chamber? Was it just for a heat adaptation protocol? What were you studying, something in particular that day?
It was really to get a taste of what we put athletes through.
Okay.
You know, it's all go and experience it for yourself. And this was a week in advance of having some ultra runners come and join us in the lab that we're going out to do an event called Marathon du Sahel in the Sahara Desert, which is a 7-day, 6-stage
Jeez.
Ultra race across the desert. So they come for a series of heat acclimation sessions. And so prior to that, you know, I was relatively new at this point. So, you know, jump in the chamber abs and
yeah.
get a taste for what these guys are going to go through. And I naively said yes. And what you'll find is when you go into those kind of conditions, you don't stand a chance of running at your normal pace. You know, you want to dial that pace right back. but I was, you know, quite content for the start, you know, oh, put it up, you know, put it up. It feels unnatural to run that slow, but yeah, you've got to really manage your pace to manage your core body temperature. And yeah, really struggle. So lesson learned.
Yeah, what an experience. And like you said, not inherently outdoor weather conditions, but I think all of our listeners will give you a pass on that because that sounds rough. It sounds rugged. And yeah, great response there. Andy Blow, what is the wildest, most extreme weather conditions, or foulest, I suppose, weather conditions you've found yourself in, indoors or outdoors?
Well, I reckon, so I've got a few tales about the heat, but one of those would be racing at the Laguna Phuket Triathlon in Thailand, which is, I was saying to Abs earlier when we were chatting that I got off the plane on like Thursday evening, I think it was, and was racing on either Saturday or Sunday. And I got off the plane and thought, I am not going to be able to race in this heat. zero time to mate. And in the end I did race, and it's kind of amazing what you can put your body through when your mind wants to. But they took me off the finish line and put me in a cold bath of water and like covered me in cold towels because I was in trouble after that.
Yeah.
But actually probably the worst I've had is at the other end of the spectrum, which was doing a bike race, a stage race on the bike in the UK. I think it was early springtime maybe. So when the weather can be one way or the other, and this day was particularly wet, like horizontal rain with sleet in it. So little bits of ice and snow in there. I remember not really having adequate gloves, and just couldn't feel my brake levers, racing in a pack, you know, downhill at 50 miles an hour. And I had one of the worst crashes I've ever had. It was a day to firmly forget. I think it was called the Tour of Wessex. And yeah, it's just one of those races I've almost managed to put to the back of my memory.
Until podcast host Andrew Harley just made you relive it right here in front of our entire audience. So
traumatic, very traumatic. Yeah.
This just became a therapy session for Andy. That's all. So guys, as we always do on Monday, when the new podcast comes out, we're going to throw this question out to you, our listeners. Make sure you are a part of the I Am Trot Out Facebook group. We just have thousands of athletes talking swim, bike, and run every single day there. So this question will go out to you. I'm excited to hear your stories, and kind of like Andy, Abby, and I, we had a lot of different stories represented today, and I can't wait to hear what you, our listeners, have to say here.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Thrilled to have Andy and Abby from Precision Fuel and Hydration joining us today. Precision Fuel and Hydration has a range of tools and products to help you personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so that you can perform at your best. Longtime listeners of the show will know them as Precision Hydration, but they've changed their name to reflect the fact that they've been helping athletes nail both aspects of their performance for a long time now. Everyone sweats differently, and the amount of fuel we require varies just depending on factors like duration and intensity of our activity. So a one-size-fits-all approach to fueling and to hydration just doesn't cut it. Head to precisionfuelandhydration.com and use their free online sweat test and quick carb calculator to understand your own fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs during training and racing. From there, you can book a free one-on-one video consultation with the team to refine your hydration fueling strategy for your next race. As a listener of the show, you can get 10% off your first order of fueling and hydration products by using the code TROTOUT10 when checking out at precisionfuelandhydration.com. So Abby, I'm going to throw you into the hot seat. First thing here today, our listeners know me way too well. They've gotten to know Andy a little bit already from, I think, Andy, this is your third time with us on the podcast. But Abby, you're brand new to our audience. So just kind of tell us, what piqued your interest in sports science, and how did your journey bring you to working with Andy at Precision Fuel and Hydration?
Well, I suppose mine's quite a classic tale of a lot of people that work in sports science. I'm a very competitive person. You might not know it if you know me socially, but I ran a lot of track in my teenage years and was very competitive. You know, if I wanted to win, I wanted to win, but was just never a good enough athlete to really do it seriously. It was very much a recreational hobby that I did around everything else. And so you know, I had a big passion for sport, big interest in it, and I've always loved biology. I've always found the human body very fascinating. So for me, it was a natural combination of the two to pursue sports science as a career. So I went to study sports science at the University of Bath. And then alongside your studies at Bath, you get the opportunity, if you wish, to do a professional placement. And it was on my placement that I met Andy. At the time, he'd already started Precision Fuel and Hydration. It was very much off the ground.
And he's an alumni of the University of Bath.
He is. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then post my studies, I joined the team full time, having kept in touch and doing a bit of part time stuff with the team. And now, several years deep, and it's completely evolved, really, hasn't it, from where it started, doing far more now than we ever were. But yeah, that's how I met Andy, was really through the University of Bath, I suppose, the link there.
Yeah, I think for years now, I think my first recollection of your name, just as a Precision Fuel and Hydration customer, you know, when the email blasts would go out from the company, it would often be, you know, Abby from Precision Hydration at the time would be who the emails would come from. And so now it's great to put a face to a name on an email. So again, thanks for joining us. And we're obviously glad here at TriDot to have you over there crunching the numbers at Precision headquarters. And we're just happy to be learning from you and Andy today. So our main objective here is learning everything we can learn from the information that y'all have learned as you've studied athlete nutrition intake in real race contexts. So as you started looking at what athletes needed in terms of on-course fuel, what sparked the idea to do these athlete case studies?
I would say it came about very organically, in that it was what we were already doing in the background. Certainly on the hydration side of things, we were already helping athletes refine their hydration strategies, you know, probing how much fluid they were drinking in a race, what that equated to per hour, and how much sodium they were having alongside that. And naturally, hydration goes pretty hand in hand with fueling. So yeah, the discussions were already happening in the background. And then I suppose the first time we did a more formal case study, we started to call it a case study, was a friend of the business, Mike, that Andy knows very well, was riding the South Downs Way, which is a lovely part of the UK. And he was going for a record. It was 100-mile record, wasn't it, across the
100 and a 200 mile
100 and a 200 mile.
So they're there, and it's like it's a point to point. He was going to do it one way, and then he was also going to go for the there and back. So it was a pretty big undertaking,
a big challenge. And so Mike approached Andy and said, look, I'm planning to do this in a couple of weeks, Andy, what do you think of what I intend to eat and drink? And we did what we've done plenty of times with athletes. We looked at the carb, sodium and fluid intake. And then post-race, because he was off to go do the 200 mile a couple of weeks later, we crunched the numbers and we said, look, Mike, this is what you did. This is where it lines up with what science would tell us really is really correct. How did you feel? You know, that's really important. Gather that subjective feedback. How do you feel it went? And then gave him some feedback and we wrote him a little report. And so it was really, really low key, but we internally found it fascinating. And so we decided to put it in the newsletter and we said something along the lines of, you know, this is the numbers that Mike hit. If you want to know how he hit them, you know, his menu is what we call it.
Okay.
let us know. And we were inundated with responses of people saying,
wow,
I want to know what Mike ate. I want to know what Mike drank. And so that was the first time we realized that athletes are hungry for this information and it's not out there. You can't really Google what did, you know, Sam Appleton eat and drink during his gold medal Ironman performance. You can't get that information. So it all tumbleweeded from there, I suppose.
Yeah. So Mike's case study was the OG. That was the original one. And it just kind of went from there. And at the time that we're recording this podcast, there are 40 case studies published on precisionfuelandhydration.com. with just a variety at this point of athletes, different types of athletes, different types of races, different temperature ranges, all represented in the case studies. You know, tell us what we can expect to find when we visit the case studies page of the website right now. What's all on there for athletes to peruse and see?
We should say, Andrew, we've got 40 triathlete case studies, but I think we're close to, not far off, 100 total case studies now, so around 90, but 40 triathlon case studies, and that's definitely our biggest sport on there, given that that's our sort of leading sport that we work with probably.
Okay.
If people visit the website, what they'll see is the homepage is a bunch of tiles, different athletes' names and the event that they competed in, the conditions and the duration of time is the kind of front tile they'll see. If you were to hover over any tile on there, you'll then see their headline numbers. And what we call the headline numbers is grams of carb they hit per hour, milliliters of fluid they hit per hour, sodium, so milligrams of sodium they took per hour, and then relative sodium concentration, which is a measure that factors in that ratio of sodium to fluid, because we know the two work closely together. If someone took, you know, a really high sodium intake but not much fluid, their relative sodium concentration would also be very high. If they took maybe a moderate sodium intake but lots and lots of fluid, their relative sodium concentration could be really quite low, even though in isolation you look at their sodium intake and you say, oh, they've done, you know, a pretty good job there. But because they've diluted it with so much fluid, the two together, they might have done, you know, what we'd class as a poorer job.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, just going back just a moment to where you were talking about how you found there to be such a hunger in athletes for this kind of information. And we found that just with our podcast. I mean, when, you know, we're in the, at the time we're recording this, the 120s on how many episodes have come out. You know, this one will probably be close to episode 130 or so. And so the, just routinely, the episodes that get the most downloads and listens, we have a pretty stable listenership. There's always a spike on nutrition episodes. It's just fascinating. I mean, people certainly are hungry for this. I think, you know, they can go out and do the swim, bike, and run training, but just that nailing that nutrition is just such a key thing. And it's just always great to see, what are other people doing? What are other athletes doing? And what can I learn from that? So we're certainly thankful to have y'all out there studying it. And we're certainly thankful to be able to learn from you. So, you know, Abby, you're one of the sports scientists conducting these athlete case studies. You said you've done close to 100 at this time, 40 on triathletes. You know, what is the process like from just initially making contact with an athlete to publishing an athlete's case study?
It's really quite simple. It's largely a conversation, be it via email or via video call. And video call is obviously preferable because you just gather so much more information and you build a rapport with the athlete, which is really important. We'll try and sit down with an athlete pre-race and get an understanding of what they plan to do, make sure it's sensible. Of course, that's what the athlete really wants. Whilst what we would like to get from it is a great case study at the end of it, we want to see these athletes perform well. So I suppose in some ways they are, and me and Andy had this conversation earlier, the data set there is somewhat skewed towards positive performances because we've often worked with these athletes for a period of time
before. Ahead of time. Yeah, it makes sense.
We sat down with them beforehand and we try to prevent them doing anything too silly. But most important step there is to sit down with them post-race, quite quickly after that race, within a day or two, or if circumstances allow, even the, you know, the evening after the race, get them to send over what they ate and drank so that it's fresh and it's much more accurate. And then following that, we have a calculator that we've built where we input what they ate and drank and it spits out the numbers.
When Abby says it's simple, I think it's simple in the respect of the goal is simple and the process is a conversation and a trading of emails, but it's what sets it apart in the way this is done when we do it is the rigor with which it's done. It's done extremely rigorously. You know, we know that in triathlon, for example, it's relatively easy to quantify what people have consumed on a bike normally because it will be X amount of bottles of either one or several different fluids, and bottles are fairly easy to predict the amount that people have drunk. If they say they've had a whole bottle, we know exactly how much it was. If they say half, it's, you know, you can get a good handle on that. We've built this incredible tool, and I say we because I've had very little to do with the building of this, but in the company, Emily have done a phenomenal job building this amazing spreadsheet that really you can put different. We can put the branded gels and energy bars and all sorts of other common foods that athletes eat into the spreadsheet, and it will break them down in terms of the the sodium content, the carbohydrate content, and any other macronutrients in there and calories, so that we can pass out that information pretty quickly and understand if it's representative. Then on the run in a triathlon, we're trying to interrogate athletes about like if they're drinking from cups at aid stations, like how many cups. We've done testing here. I was literally in the kitchen here again the other day reconfirming some of the how much is a cup size, you know, is it 2 ounces per mouthful or 1.5 ounces or one, and we get all of that information and then basically plug the numbers in and it spits out kind of those headline numbers. And then from the quality of the data, when you look at our case studies, if you go right to the bottom, you'll see something which is called a data confidence score, which is essentially Abs and Emily and myself sometimes having a conversation around how accurate do we feel that particular athlete's recall was. For example, we did a 24-hour running race with an athlete where, because all of the food was handed up to them from the side of the track and we could measure everything, you could be incredibly accurate in terms of the rigor with which you recorded what was being consumed. Way easier actually than in an Ironman, as you know from your study. You know, it's kind of, you have to just recall what you're doing. But what we found is that by doing, I think in each study, there's always going to be an inherent small amount of error just because some of these things are estimated. But the power in this comes with the volume of data that we're gathering and the trends that it shows. And I think that's an important point to make as well. Is as much as one case study can be incredibly useful for an individual, collectively, they're really powerful in telling you like trends about what people tend to do and what tends to work for people or not.
Yeah. So Andy, as you alluded to, one of the 40 triathlon case studies features an alarmingly average age group athlete, Andrew Harley, yours truly, and several of our triathlon athletes, they've already seen that case study and they thought it was funny how when you look at the page of triathlete case studies, you have names like Sam Appleton, Emma Pollan-Brown, Jeannie Metzler, Sarah Crowley, Ruth Astle. I mean, just to name a few, and you see their eight-ish hour full distance finish times, their four-ish hour, 70.3 finish times. And right next to them on the page is Andrew Harley in his 12-hour and 49-minute finish. So, I mean, it was an honor to be included on the list. I was certainly happy to do it. And after the race, Abby, just like you described, I sent off all the information to you and Emily, as well as I could remember it. And it's challenging, right? Andy, you talked about just measuring, okay, in the on-course race cups, like, how much fluid is actually held in there? And then as you're going through an aid station, you're grabbing two and pouring some on your head and drinking some. And even for my own handheld bottle, Abby, when I was trying to recall, okay, how much fluid did I drink from my handheld bottle? I would fill it up at aid stations. I would take a sip and I'd pour half the bottle on my head. And so recalling how much, I was taking in was a little difficult on the back end. I think my, accuracy of information on the back end was somewhere in the middle of your rating, whereas that 24-hour race you referenced had a high degree of confidence in that data set. So Andy, Abby, once you have that list of what was consumed by an athlete, what are you looking for in the results?
We're looking at how many grams of carb we take per hour, fluid intake, and sodium intake. What we describe as the three levers. That's any endurance activity you're doing, race, training session, you've got three acute costs of that exercise. You're burning through energy, your carbohydrates, you're losing fluids through sweat, and you're losing sodium, again, through sweat. And they're the three things that you want to be replacing in different proportions, depending on your individual physiology, but also the conditions that you're in, the intensity and duration that you're exercising for, and a bunch of other factors. And so that's why you'll see such variation in those case studies, different numbers for fluid, carb, sodium. But on occasions, they'll each receive green, although there's a spread, because they were appropriate for that scenario and for that athlete. And so you kind of touched upon it, Andrew, a little bit. The case studies there are a great learning tool for individuals to look at. Hopefully they can go there, read what other athletes are doing and learn something from it. Take something from it. They're not to be directly copied. They're an example of what worked for one athlete. And we're happy to have individual discussions with athletes. We do free 20-minute video consultations with athletes where we can discuss their circumstances, their racing, what's worked for them. But everyone is individual. And so the headline numbers are what we're looking for, but then we sit down with an athlete and we dive into what worked for them, get their feedback, and then we do a full write-up, which hopefully dissects those headline numbers and explains perhaps why they've received an amber for one but a green for another. But then on the next race, it might have changed. And that's why the full case study is important. We didn't touch upon it in the previous answer, but once you click into one of those tiles, you receive the headline numbers again at the top, their menu beneath that, some race information down the side. And then
it's very thorough. There's a lot to digest there on each individual case study. They're very fascinating to look at.
There is. Some of them are lengthy pieces. They're bedtime reading for sure.
Yeah.
but it's often required, we feel. You need to tell the full story. The numbers are interesting at the top, but you need the context alongside that.
I think it's a case of zooming in and zooming out, because when athletes first talk to us, usually the typical athlete conversation around fueling starts off as a description of the products that they take. We immediately try to change that conversation to look at the numbers. So rather than them telling us, oh, well, I like these kind of energy bars and I have a few of those and I have this and that, it's like, well, that's not what it's about at this point. At the planning point, it's all about having an appreciation for what you're trying to put into your body, why and how much. And as Abs has said, it's about boiling it down at that point to simple carbs, fluid, sodium. Once you get beyond that, then you kind of can zoom back in a little bit onto the products themselves. And it's all of a sudden, it's like not, oh, I'm going to take X amount of these bars per hour. It's like, well, X amount of these bars per hour gives me Y amount of carbohydrates. So actually, I know now I need 2.5 bars or whatever that number is. So it's a case of the reason we've majored so much on the headline numbers and the green, amber, red system for coding them is that we believe that that's where the conversation needs to start. And then as Abs has said, getting into the case study detail, that's when you get the context, the nuance, the actual menu, and you start to piece the story back together. But without anchoring it around those numbers, you're just talking about what you might fancy eating on a bike ride or something. And that's not, even though that's typically the way a lot of people approach it, it's probably not the most productive for performance.
I'm excited for our listeners to go find my case study and see how much of my inputs were green versus amber versus red, because those you keep alluding to those color codings. The green is you nailed this part. You took in the recommended ranges of this particular part of your nutrition plan. The amber is you were just outside of the recommended ranges, and the red is you were well outside of your recommended ranges. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I think that's a fair comment. I'd say if something's red, it's that it's far enough out that it might have affected performance.
Okay.
Amber is you did a pretty good job. It just could have been slightly better. And green is spot on. We're really happy with this.
We've got to always remember that triathlon, like at any other sport, performance is measured by performance outcomes. So you have definitely got case studies in the armory where people have achieved the goal that they set out to achieve, and you'd be one of those people. You completed, that was your first Ironman, you completed it in good shape,
and that was the goal.
Exactly, yeah. And so to an extent that we've given you amber on most of your nutrition intakes there, but you hit your goal. So the fact that we might advise you to tweak some of those numbers to get them closer to green in your next race, if you're going to go again, in order to sort of support a high level of performance, is significant. But you can definitely have a good race with occasionally poor aspects to your nutrition. I would hesitate to say that in a really long race you can completely screw up your nutrition and still bluff through, but there is a huge, we've got to remember that in triathlon especially, it's a very physical sport. Performance is largely dictated by fitness level, and nutrition, fueling, hydration, it's a big pillar that supports that. But the fitter you are, the more leeway you've got with having a little bit of wiggle room to get some of those things wrong. I don't think you can always say that it's always an aim, really, to get your nutrition metrics in the kind of green zone. But you certainly, it's not a barrier to performance to be just outside of those some of the time.
Okay.
Ultimately, there's bigger factors than what you eat and drink that drive your performance.
Yeah, great point. And this is something Abby said earlier. You can book a 20-minute call with a member of the Precision Fuel and Hydration team on the website and find out what your needs are. And that way you can look at case studies that are a little bit closer in the ballpark to probably what your needs are and learn what those people did. So that's also a great tool that you have set up for athletes to take advantage of. So let's talk a little bit about what you've already learned from the data that's come in. You've talked about just the power in the cumulative data set. So from the 40 triathlete case studies, the 100 or so of the overall case studies, let's just kind of go kind of metric by metric here. What have you learned about carbohydrate when it comes to athletes from these data sets?
I would say one of the biggest things that we've learned is that a lot of the data that we've got is currently with high performance athletes, you know, people who are closer to the front of the race, and the figures that they're hitting on carbohydrate are nearly all, if not within the guideline recommendations, are either within them or above them in general. There's very Wow. few cases where people are skimping on eating carbohydrates and being at or near the front of a race. And that's not the same as saying if you eat a lot of carbohydrates, it will get you to the front of the race. But it's saying if you are fit enough to be there, you know, punching your weight at the front of an Ironman.
And if you've trained your gut a little bit, probably, yeah, to tolerate that.
Yeah, those two things go hand in hand. Then you probably not only will benefit from taking in quite a lot of carbs, but you'll need to. So when we say quite a lot, the entry level even for quite a lot is probably 60 grams an hour. And the optimal is probably closer to 80 or 90 with a few examples going beyond that. So I think that would be a fair trend to start with. The other one that's really interesting, which Abby's already kind of covered, was just this idea that we would always prescribe an athlete to have to aim for more carbohydrate per hour on the bike than on the run in an Ironman. But we're seeing quite consistently with some of the faster runners that they're holding up the intake on the run, but that at 70.3 and a middle distance races, you can definitely be economical with what you eat and drink on the run if you front load the bike, which again, if you're aiming to run fast, is probably an advantage, because clearly, you know, we all know what it's like if you try to eat and drink when you're running on an Olympic or sprint distance, 5 or 10K, it's really difficult to do. And if you're pretty fit, your half marathon running pace is probably it's going to drop from your 10K pace, but not by a huge amount. And I think that's perhaps one of the explanations for that, and is a good reason for athletes to consider being a bit more aggressive with their intake on the bike during middle distance races, because it allows you the latitude to skip a few aid stations on the run and keep powering forward if you're going for a good time.
I'll add one bit on carb, Andrew, because I think it's a topic that people like to talk about.
Yeah.
I
love carbs.
We don't see big differences between what males and females are doing.
Great.
Interesting.
The question that we get a lot, are there differences between males and females? We get it on the hydration side, we get it on the carb side. And what we're seeing in the data, the averages are virtually identical. Again, ranges on both sides, but the average comes out very similar.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So another metric you track past carbs is overall fluid intake. Is that the same on fluid intake as well?
It is. Yeah. Again, ranges both sides. It's fluid is a little bit all over the place. It's very dependent on what the conditions are, but we see averages sitting very, very close.
Very cool. What are the other trends that you see when it comes to just fluids and what people are drinking during their races?
Much like carbohydrate, typically athletes are drinking more on the bike. It's just a greater opportunity. They've got their bottles there. It's far easier. And you see that tapering in fluid on the run. That's probably, there's noise on the run there. Like Andy said earlier, there is a lot more estimating going on with estimating how much fluid athletes are taking on the run section, because it's cups from aid stations. We're having to estimate how much fluid was a mouthful, was a gulp, was a big drink. You know, like you said, Andrew, they're throwing it on their face and some's going in, but majority going around here. So we do see a tapering, but yeah, it's fluid is far more difficult to draw trends and patterns from because there's just so many variables involved.
I think I'd stick my neck out and say, you know, the fluid conversation is one to have in another 12 months time when we've got a much bigger data set, because what you need there, because those numbers are all over the map, you do need to start to draw some conclusions when you've got a much larger data set to begin with. But I reckon what we're going to continue to see is wider and wider outliers. I mean, I remember just using myself as an example in a middle distance race. I raced in the UK one year, a race called the Weymouth Triathlon, which was kind of a small town, you know, moderately competitive race. And I was one of the first out the water. It jumped on the bike. It was a rainy, cold day, even though it was in the summer. And went over a speed hump in the road, you know, as you leave the kind of car park where the transition was. And one of my two bottles for the bike ride bounced out of the cage. But I was with another guy who was like 15, 20 meters up the road. And at that point, there is no way I'm stopping to go back and pick up. So I just put my head down and went. There was one aid station on the course. I classically, you know, failed. I put my hand out, tried to grab the bottle, knocked it out of the guy's hand. And I had a 16-ounce bottle for the whole thing. And then it was wet and cold. And I remember doing that whole race. And I probably only managed to, I was running flat out on the run. I probably managed a couple of cupfuls of water on the run at the most the whole way around. And so I would have predicted that my fluid intake on that race, even though I did pretty well and put in a good time, was absolutely like pitiful. It would have been absolutely tiny. And I think as we test more, as we get more case studies, we'll find a few more outliers like that and a few more outliers like our Luke Henderson example at the other end, of people who are drinking more and more and more. And that then, at the very least, enables us to kind of bookend this, which is the first place you start when you're then trying to tell people what's plausible. And over time, what I really hope is that we get a nice bell curve kind of situation going on where we can at least say to people, look, not only based on this what science might tell us, but based on hundreds or thousands of case studies, we can actually see that the median amount of fluid or the mean amount of fluid that people are taking in certain races and conditions is this. And that will give people something to key off. Because at least then you can know if you're a higher than average sweater, the chances are your number is going to be higher than whatever the average in our database is. Or if you're a lower than average sweater, you're probably safe operating a little bit lower than that. So I think that's the kind of longer term aim with the fluid side relations.
Yeah, no, makes sense. And at least at that point, we as athletes would have a bell curve to reference and kind of know where on that curve we should position ourselves. Another thing that could be an evolution of this, you know, just tracking fluid is just to have Abby run alongside a couple athletes for their Ironman marathon or half marathon and just jot down some notes on how much are they drinking.
But that has been suggested internally. I've turned that down.
You said rollerblades.
Rollerblades is, yeah, that's brilliant.
Well, to be fair as well, Ab stayed up for 24 hours to do the full record at the 24-hour running event as well. So, you know, we've got four. For ridiculous suggestions.
Another one and done. Yeah.
If I think of anything else, I'll shoot it y'all's way. So, so something obviously that goes hand in hand with tracking fluid is tracking sodium. That is probably the heartbeat of precision fuel and hydration, is tracking the sodium to hydrate to fluid relationship. So, what are the trends you're seeing cumulatively from the data set, and what athletes are doing with their sodium intake?
I think at the moment, what's interesting is, we, of course, have the advanced sweat test where we can measure an athlete's sweat sodium concentration. And we've done thousands and thousands of tests now. And just like Andy was discussing with the fluid building this bell-shaped curve, we've already built that in for sweat sodium concentration. And we see the average sit at around 950 milligrams of sodium per liter lost. And again, you've got people right down each end and everyone in between, but that's where the average, the peak of that bell-shaped curve is falling. And from the case studies that we've done so far, the average relative sodium concentration we're seeing athletes consume is just shy of the 900 milligrams per liter mark. And so that's a nice marrying up there. The average that people are losing per litre is around 950, and we're seeing the average that athletes are replacing in racing just shy of 900.
Okay.
So I think that tells a nice story, and it's just on the, like Andy said, on the fluid side, we need to wait really a good few more months, another season of data collection, get far more case studies to really draw any solid conclusions. But the averages are lining up nicely, and we see we're seeing a big, big range. You know, Luke Henderson is right at the top end of that continuum. And then we've got people that don't sweat as much, haven't got as high sweat sodium concentrations, and we're seeing them replace far less. You know, it's nice to see what we've been talking to athletes about for years. It's nice to see that out in practice really happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I'd add to that as well with the sodium, a couple of cases, because looking at yours in particular, and also there was another example, one of the early ones when we worked with Jeannie Metzler, who's a pro athlete who was a podium finisher at the 70.3 Worlds last year. Both so Jeannie had a test and found out her sweat sodium concentration was relatively on the high side. And then from that information, especially when she was going into a hotter race, was relatively aggressive, or very aggressive, with her sodium intake. And one of the first things we ended up doing with her was actually dialing that back a little bit, because we tend to see that when athletes, if they have knowledge of having relatively high sweat sodium losses and they're going into hot races, there's a bit of a nagging feeling of, you know, taking a bit more salt as an insurance policy.
Yeah.
And I think that may have even been the case with yours to an extent. You know, you're looking at the average sodium concentration on yours, it was pretty punchy, and it was a hot day when you raced in your Ironman.
In Waco, yep.
On average, I would say we're encouraging athletes to take a little bit more sodium, but there is a cohort of athletes, and then sometimes in hotter conditions, people get that message and take it a bit far. And we're always mindful to be saying, look, it's very possible to take a bit too much as well. The penalty for not taking enough is relatively severe, but there are penalties for taking too much. So that's another thing that's been borne out, rather than in the big numbers, in a couple of individual studies. And I think that's affecting how we communicate this to athletes, to make sure that we're saying, look, it's not always more is better. I think we've been pretty strong on that message for a long time, actually, but it's doubling down on it to make sure that people, because I know what it feels like when you're going into a race yourself. Especially when you're stepping into the unknown with like more extreme conditions. And that's probably, you know, the kind of stuff that we need to help people avoid, so they just don't go too far the wrong way.
So to Abby and Emily's credit, when we were talking before Ironman Waco, and they asked for kind of my plan, what I was going to take, I had a pretty well thought out plan that I had practiced in my longer stamina sessions. And when I was sending them my plan, the one thing I changed that I had not been doing in my own long stamina sessions was I was used to taking a precision hydration salt pill every 20 to 25 minutes. And just going into the race, I was like, you know what? It's going to be really hot. I know I sweat a lot. It's going well, taking them every 20 minutes in training. I'm going to dial it up to taking one every 15 minutes, because why not? And so I had that in my head. I put that on my plan, and I don't remember if it was Abby or Emily, but one of the two of them emailed me back, and they're like, hey, your plan looks great. You know, with the numbers we've crunched, we think it's going to go well for you. The one thing we'll say, you shouldn't take a salt pill every 15 minutes. That is way too aggressive. And so they talked me off the exact ledge you're referencing, Andy, and I was able to take an appropriate amount. And still, like you have alluded to, I probably took too much salt and could have used, I think if I'm, we'll talk about my case study in a little bit, but if I remember correctly, what one of the findings was I could have benefited from more water and less salt on the run. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. One more thing that you guys track, is caffeine. And we will at some point in the future have a caffeine podcast episode, but just in terms of today with the case studies, as you're asking athletes to report the caffeine they're consuming during a race, what are you learning from that?
Where to start with that one? I think caffeine is misunderstood, which is one of the reasons why it is going to be good to have a proper podcast chat with you about it. Because everyone is, the concept to say carbohydrate is very simple. It's like you need an amount per hour. It's fuel. It gets burnt. And when it's gone, it's gone. It's sort of, it's in and out the body. With caffeine, the way that caffeine behaves in the body is it obviously has an effect on the brain and the nervous system, which is not directly linked. It is linked to the dose, but it's not an immediate effect, and it's not an effect that goes away quickly. So it's
okay.
So with caffeine, a trend that we see is that people often use caffeine pretty late on in races because they want the perceived kick that they think they will feel from taking caffeine, when in actual fact, we know that caffeine doesn't hit your bloodstream for 15 minutes and can take up to 45 or 60 minutes to actually peak in the bloodstream.
Wow.
And it's got a huge, what's called half-life, which is the amount of time it takes to decay in the body to the point where it's half as potent as it was. And that can be 5 or 6 hours
Maybe
with some people. So you kind of, you know, you get this like, take it, it ramps up slowly and then gives you its maximal effectiveness 30 to 60 minutes after you've taken it. And then it's a very slow decline. So for a lot of endurance sports, pre-caffeinating is the way to go because you take the caffeine in the build-up, breakfast and a small top-up before the start. So it's you're starting with high levels. It helps to suppress fatigue. And it's only in really long races like Ironman, arguably for some people, maybe a half Ironman distance, you might take some caffeine in the middle part to give you a boost at the end. But one of the trends we see is caffeine being taken left a little bit late. And then the other trend is people just having absolutely no idea on dosages. So
yeah,
probably Abs is good, well placed to talk about that.
So when we're collecting that data on caffeine intake, we do look at total caffeine intake, so milligrams they've taken across that race. But it's actually the better measurement to take is milligrams per kilogram of body weight. It's unusual in that sense. Unlike carbs, which we measure in grams per hour, we don't factor in an athlete's body weight, and there is a reason for that, but I won't, it's a bit of a digression.
Sure.
But caffeine dosage is prescribed per kilogram of body weight, and the sort of general guideline for performance is that between 3 to 6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body weight is like the sweet spot. Now, as Andy just discussed, I would include pre-caffeinating in that because of how long it stays in the system for. Again, the average half-life is around 4 hours, but caffeine is muddied. It's a difficult topic to sort of coherently educate someone on because it's muddied by individual tolerances, individual sensitivities, different people's metabolism. You've got habitual users that there is some evidence that people kind of get more tolerant to the effects. And so all of those factors, again, it's very individual. So how much an athlete should be taking, the phrase "it depends" does kind of come in.
Yeah.
If we were to pull a trend from what we've seen triathletes doing, the average dose is looking at about 3.8 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram in our triathlete case studies, which is, again, you know, nicely within that boundary, that 3 to 6. But we also work with a lot of athletes that go for long races, you know, ultra races. Andy's discussed, we've worked with some athletes doing 24-hour events. Now, where that guideline, that 3 to 6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram starts to fall down is it's completely independent of time. So because of that half-life of caffeine, in theory, every 4 hours, the amount you've got in the body is decreasing by half. So by hour 12, caffeine could be completely out of your system. And so you want to be, of course, redosing. And that's what we do see athletes do. They kind of drip feed caffeine throughout their performance. Once they start, they often don't stop. But if you then look at, if we take a 24-hour runner and look at their total dose, it could be way above 6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram because accumulatively they've had to take a lot more to keep that, you know, acceptable dose in their system. So it's something that we are very, very interested in. It's something we're internally doing a lot of research on, and it's something that we get a lot of questions about from athletes. And I think if you guys are going to record, you know, you've got this other recording coming up soon, I think it'll be a very, very interesting listen.
From all this learning you've done, you know, tracking fluid, tracking carbohydrate, tracking caffeine, you know, just all the takeaways and understandings that you've cumulatively gathered from these case studies, you know, how has all this information influenced the development of your fueling products?
I'd say one example is anyone that's familiar with our fueling products, we make really clear on the front how many grams of carb.
Yeah, I love that.
Our drink has, and now we've got the PF90 gel, which is 90 grams of carb per single pouch. So what we've learned from trying to prescribe athletes, you know, helping them hit these numbers, is let's make that as easy for them as possible. Let's make it really clear, because other brands out there of gel, some have 20, some have 22, 24, 25. There's a right old range. And granted, you know, it's, you could say it's somewhat in the noise, but we want to help athletes make this easy, take something off their plate. There's a lot of stress that goes on prior to race day. So let's, you know, take one thing out of the equation. So that would be, from my perspective, the numbers. And then I know Andy would say the jumbo gel, as we affectionately call it, the gel. That really, the idea for that came from these case studies, seeing what athletes are actually doing. A lot of athletes will, on long course, run with a small flask on the run, and they were decanting three or four gels into a little flask. You know, why not just,
why not just make them a pouch with 90 grams of carbohydrate gel in it already? And that's what we've tried to do. But I think, you know, we do product feedback. We've got a good bunch of people in the team who are doing these kind of activities, and that's where we always start, obviously, when we put things out. And then our approach is usually make sure that it's tested thoroughly within our group. It goes out to our ambassadors, and then it goes out into the wider community. And then we're constantly, where we can, making feedback and changes. And one of the things, we haven't got a date and a you know, this isn't in our immediate product pipeline, but from the case studies, we learned that on Ironman, and we kind of knew this anyway, but a lot of people will put all of their gels into a bottle on the bike to make it easy. So there is a school of thought we're discussing at the moment as to whether we produce our energy gel, as you know, is like a very mild, neutral taste. And rather than going down the road of lots and lots of different flavors and fancy sort of taste for the product, one thing we are exploring doing is making a thinner gel specifically to go in the bike bottle. So effectively not actually increasing the water content necessarily, because you don't want to water it down and decrease the carbs, but creating a consistency and a viscosity that works really well to come out of the nozzle of a bike bottle, versus on the run, people want something with a bit more texture and a bit more mouthfeel and something a bit thicker. So those are the kind of things that, from doing these case studies and talking to athletes about what they're, how they're using the products in anger, we can then feed that back into development. We've, another one is, for example, we've got an energy chew coming fairly soon, because there are a cohort of people. I mean, I have never had a problem eating energy gels, and
yeah, same.
Gels are really good, but there is definitely a cohort of people out there that just have put their hands up and said, "Look, I just can't deal with gels. Maybe it's a texture thing, or they've had a bad experience with them in the past, and just it's very off-putting." So we've got an energy chew, which again, 30 grams of carbs. So we wanted to make them interchangeable units in your plan to make it as easy as possible. And then I guess another thing that we've really learned from the case studies was just how many athletes were using caffeine and in what way. So we always had a caffeinated energy gel in our product pipeline, but we've pulled the development of that forward massively to the point where it should be out in the next few months, just because we know that that people are wanting to use it. You know, they're crying out for something like that. So yeah, they would probably be the main areas. But it's overall, I would say the case studies are just a wonderful way of us keeping really, really closely in touch with how our products and other products in the and foodstuffs are being used by athletes. So it keeps you bang up to date with what everyone's doing.
I highly encourage athletes to head to the website, precisionfuelandhydration.com, and go look at some of the case studies on there. It's just, like we've discussed, a really interesting read, you know, just to see what people are doing, the fuel for their races. Andy, Abby, for folks that are heading to the website, what are a couple case studies that they should go look at where an athlete really nailed it? And maybe what is an example where an athlete kind of sort of maybe could have done things a little bit better?
I think Luke Henderson is one example to go look at, for as an individual who got it right for him. He he totally did what he needed to do for his circumstances. Emma Pallant is interesting because there's plenty of hers on there, so they're worth clicking through and seeing when she got it right and potentially sometimes when it went a little bit wrong. And then the third one I'd say is Leon Chevalier, and in particular his Ironman Mallorca case study, where Leon is very meticulous in his approach. He's really on it with his numbers and his understanding of this process. He pays real attention to it and he really bought into it from the off. And at Mallorca, he had a, much like Andy losing his bottle coming out of transition in the race he spoke about, I think Leon might have been going over some cobbles or something and lost one of his bottles, which was very carb rich and very sodium rich. Now, Leon being Leon, knew exactly how many grams of carb he just lost.
Wow.
Didn't panic and just worked off of gels that were available on the aid stations to make sure that he still met his needs, which sounds really, you know, relatively simple. But you'd be surprised how many athletes would completely lose their heads and start doing really silly rogue things.
Yeah.
What was, you know, not sad, but that was incredibly sodium rich, his bottle, and that he did struggle to replace. But fortunately, he got enough kind of precautions. He had some salt capsules with him that saw him through. Leon's quite salty. But he had an amazing performance and he got gold that race. Yeah. So I think any of Leon's are great reads.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting there is Leon won Ironman Mallorca and he'd done very well or won long distance races in the past before that. But this was his first season of doing long distance races, and the journey that he went on and the learning curve that he went on was very steep and rapid. He didn't do things too badly in his first race at Bolton, but we worked pretty closely with him through there, the Alpe d'Huez long course, through Embrunman, which is an iron distance race in France. And he basically evolved incredibly quickly because he'd got the data on each one. And you can see the kind of evolution through the stories to the point where by the end of the season, I mean, he had a big year and did four big long distance races, but his improvement in those from a fueling perspective and a hydration perspective was marked, and that's probably quite useful for people to look at as to how you can evolve.
No kidding.
If you're prepared to look at the numbers and look at the data, because otherwise what happens, the typical approach is people do it, don't really understand what they did. If it doesn't work, they have to go back to the drawing board and completely try again. But whereas for him, he's kind of come through strong, and you know, we're excited to be working with him this year because he's got a really big year ahead with Ironman St. George in Utah and the World Champs, where he's qualified as a pro, and then looking ahead to maybe also, you know, trying to get to Kona later in the year.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
We have a healthy amount of podcast listeners and tryout athletes in the UK. And I mean, the UK actually ranks third behind the United States and Canada in tryout podcast listenership. And several other European countries are in our top 10. We talk about races in the United States just by default, if that's where our team lives and trains and races. So while I've got Andy and Abby with us today, I thought we could close out today by hearing Andy and Abby's top five must-do UK-based races. Andy and Abby have firsthand knowledge on the race scene in the United Kingdom. So if you're one of our European athletes, that this can serve as a close-ish to home recommendation list. And for our non-European audience, maybe you'll hear something you decide is worth a racecation. Andy, Abby, from all the races you've done and all the races you've seen, anything and everything in the endurance sports sphere is fair game here. What race experiences make Andy and Abby's top five must-do UK-based race list?
Well, I think I'm going to start with one I've not done myself, but it's got such a reputation in recent years that it is about the only triathlon that I've heard about that makes me want to get on my bike and go and, you know, get involved again. It's the Helvellyn Triathlon, it's called, up in the Lake District in England. It's marketed and is genuinely perceived to be one of the hardest triathlons in the world. It's on the bike ride, it's got unbelievable elevation, including a hill a sort of mountain climb, which is called The Struggle. That's the name. That okay. is the, actually the name of the hill on the bike.
Perfect.
And the run goes up and down Helvellyn, which is one of the highest peaks in the Lake District. So it's a fell run up and down there. A swim, I think it's in Ullswater, which is one of the nicest lakes in the Lake District. And that is, I think, just apart from anything else, if you've never been to that part of the UK, it's one of the most beautiful places you can go and visit, and probably one of the hardest events on the calendar. So, and I think it's in September time. So that the Helvellyn Triathlon would be a definite must do from me.
Hmm. That's a tough one to follow. I'm going to also say an event I've not personally done, but that I am going to support later on in this year. And that would be, it's part of a race series called the Castle Series, and it's the one at Hever Castle. It's called the Festival of Endurance. It's a whole weekend of racing. It's in Kent, so relatively central in the UK, you know, close to London. Lovely scenery again. And you can do almost any discipline. It is a weekend of triathlon, but you can do a duathlon, you can just run, you can just cycle.
No, very cool.
Swim, I think you can do an aquathon. So there's almost something for anyone. And it's in early July, so it should be, you know, nice sunny conditions. Touch wood. I mean, it's UK, so you can't guarantee the weather either in July, but fingers crossed. And as I say, we'll be supporting that one. So you athletes, anyone doing that, can come and meet some of the members of the team, meet myself. We'll have product there and just, we can just have a chat.
Yeah. Another one, another real classic one is the Windsor Triathlon in the UK, which has been around since, I think, probably the late 80s, certainly the early 90s. It's been won by some of the biggest old school names in the sport, like Spencer Smith and Simon Lessing, and more recently British Olympians like Tim Don and Stuart Hayes have won the race. It's a non-drafting Olympic distance race. You swim in the River Thames, you bike around Windsor near Windsor Castle, which is one of the Queen's residences, and it's just that's a definite one, which you're not really a proper Brit triathlete if you've not done the Windsor Triathlon, I would say.
So that sounds like it. Yeah, it sounds like it would qualify for that.
If you were visiting, you can fly into Heathrow Airport, which is probably about, you know, I don't know, 15, 20 miles from there at the most, and in and out. It's real easy.
All right. So there's our 1, 2, and 3. We got two more slots here to fill. What's number 4 and 5?
I'm going to go a bit rogue and away from triathlon. I've got an event coming up in August, at the end of August. There's an event here in the UK. I don't know if they are global, but it's called the OM. It's the Original Mountain Marathon. And I'm not actually doing that one, but doing an event which is the same premise. And it's fell running and orienteering over 2 days. Wow. Doing the one off in Scotland on the Isle of Arran. The scenery looks stunning. So hopefully that will distract me from the pain. I've never done something that's more than a day long. But I think it's a good mix of running endurance and something a bit fun with some orienteering. And I know they do an Irish one and one up in the peaks. So again, if you want to see some beautiful UK scenery, and after something a little bit different, I'd check those out. This one's called the Kong Mountain Marathon, which is rather fun, I think.
Yeah, sounds good. I would say another one which is closer to triathlon, but not quite all the way there, because I know you and I have chatted about swim run before a little bit, Andrew.
Yep.
There's a few great swim run races popping up in the UK, and I'm a huge advocate for that sport, because especially as someone who's really time crunched, training for the bike is often the most difficult and time consuming.
Absolutely.
And I've managed over the years to keep myself relatively swim and run fit, so I can go and do some of these races. You can race in pairs. There's a few series in the UK now, but we're good friends with a guy called John Yelland, who organises the Mad Hatter swim runs, which are down in Cornwall. It's a really cool place to go and visit. You're swimming in the Atlantic Ocean, so there's waves, or there can be waves and kind of cold water and jagged rocks and that kind of stuff. It's kind of grassroots and rough and ready, but really, really cool scenery. And they put on a number of swim run races. So the Mad Hatter swim run series is like a must do. Certainly a real antidote to the big race day, you know, where everything's very expensive and very corporate and
very branded, and
yeah, these are far more, you know, everyone ends up in the same pub afterwards for a few pints, and it's a really authentic experience. So I'd say that's worth checking out.
Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank Andy Blow and Abby Coleman from Precision Fuel and Hydration for giving us nutrition insight from their work with the athlete case studies. Remember that you can book a call with one of their sweat experts to form your own race day fuel and hydration strategy. Head to precisionfuelandhydration.com to check out the case studies, learn more about your own fueling needs, and use the code TRIDOT10 for 10% off your first order. Enjoying the podcast? Have any triathlon questions or topics you want to hear us talk about? Head to TRIDOT.com/podcast and let us know what you're thinking. We'll have a new show coming your way soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.